Good morning. It is a privilege to be here, and I appreciate the fact that you are have come out to listen to us. Just a note on the title. It has actually changed a little bit since I sent you the proposal. A short title will be Evolutionary Creation and the Character of God, with special reference to animal pain and suffering. A couple comments before I begin the paper. I will use theistic evolution and evolutionary creation interchangeably. So sometimes you will hear one term, sometimes the other. I use them interchangeably. I quote quite a bit in my paper. I will not mention when it's quotes and end quote because it will be quite disruptive. Credit is given in the written work. To begin, I will just first define theistic evolution for you. And I will do so with William Debski's definition in the following context. Darwinian evolutionary scientists assert confidently that the Genesis account is mythology, that the Earth is billions of years old, that the first primitive living organism emerged from a chemical soup by some combination of chance and chemical laws, and that life thereafter evolved to its present diversity by natural means, guided by natural selection, but not by God. Theistic evolution basically defends the same account, adding that the evolutionary process was sustained and guided by God in a way that is not easily detected by scientific investigation. Now, theistic evolution has the advantage of making peace between science and theology. Yet there is risk. The risk is that the theodicy problem, as Adriani mentioned earlier, could become exacerbated. The evolution of life over deep time includes acknowledgement that predators kill prey for food and that the vast majority of species go extinct in order to make room for new life. Survival of the fittest, or the law of the jungle, is the law of nature. Thus, Darwin's scheme, which both extended the narrative of creaturely suffering over vast spans of geological time and embedded that suffering within the process by which value arose, is one of the most intriguing hypotheses the theist had had to face. As can be noted, in an evolutionary creation, suffering is not a latecomer on the scene. The chief reason the theist has had to struggle with this issue of natural theodicy resides in the apparent incongruity between what the evolutionary theory implies about creaturely suffering and the biblical and long-held belief that God is benevolent. Michael Kuhn's cuts to the core of the issue we're struggling with today. The more crucial question is not the theoretical presence of God, but what kind of God is he? And as Dr. John Baldwin, our professor, has pointed out, people think that the sheer fact of creation is enough to warrant the worship of God. But the question is, what kind of creation warrants the worship of God, the Creator? How we understand God's character will directly affect our faith in him and our readiness to worship him. And many have felt that natural evil presents a greater difficulty for belief in God than moral evil because it cannot be put down to the misuse of free will of creatures. Randy Alcorn suggests that we cannot understand evil without understanding the nature of God. And standing in agreement with him, it is to these two aspects so forcefully interdependent that I turn in this paper, natural evil and the character of God in theistic evolution. The main question I will try to answer is, how does the presence of animal pain and death before the appearance of human beings reflect on the character of God? And my paper has two sections. The first part, I will try to present some of the ways in which evolutionary creationists justify the benevolence of God. In the second part of my paper, I will analyze and critique their justification. While generally theologians may consent that human beings are responsible for some forms of evil and suffering, the pain that accompanies creatures in their process of becoming could not be the result of human agency, because it is presumed that God employed this method before human beings came into existence. And so much potential for pain and suffering existed in the pre-human world. Furthermore, in theistic evolution, evolutionary suffering is generally no longer regarded as a result of human sin because it can be found where no sin exists. Therefore, we must concur with Gregerson, who draws the only conclusion plausible for one who believes in a God who creates life through evolution. Biological death has to be attributed to the Creator. Evolutionary creationists build their justification of God's goodness upon the basic premise that death is a thermodynamic necessity. Accordingly, pain is readily defined in terms of prerequisite for life. In evolution, the process of life involves the disvalues of suffering and extinction generated by competition for scarce resources. Adaptation for life is an imperfect process, but if it were perfect, evolution would cease and so life would not appear. Therefore, the imperfection plays a vital role because it is the imperfection that drives the world towards perfection, the disvalue that is necessary in the search for more value. Natural selection requires disvalues in its exploration for values, but selects against them to leave the values in place. Thus, in theistic evolution, evil is to some extent simply an unavoidable byproduct of a world undergoing evolutionary unification from a state of initial multiplicity. Evolutionary creationists maintain that the evolutionary process, far from being irrational, is a prototype of the only kind of rationality we know. They suggest that only a system of concomitant values and disvalues is a valuable one. There must be an interplay of order and disorder if there is to be autonomy, freedom, adventure, success, achievement, surprise, and ideographic particularity. Southgate echoes the proposal, arguing that the sort of universe we have, in which complexity emerges in a process governed by thermodynamic necessity and Darwinian natural selection, and therefore by death, pain, predation, and self-assertion, is the only sort of universe that could give rise to the range of beauty, complexity, and diversity the Earth has produced. The dynamic of value-disvalue, or otherwise put, of good and evil, inherent in the rationality of theistic evolution, implies the necessary and concomitant presence of both aspects if one is to exist. In a world in which there are selves, there's going to be competition among these selves, as surely as there must be some cooperation. There are going to be winners and losers. If the environment can be good, that brings also the possibility of deprivation and harm. Things can go wrong just because they can also go right, asserts theistic evolution. Reasoning further, evolutionary creationists suggest that only the presence of these values can assure balance between two unappealing alternatives of either too much rigidity or complete chaos. Too much distinctness yields disorder, chaos, contingency. Too much connection yields rigidity, determinism, and order. Complexity, they say, must be situated between order and disorder, or at the edge of chaos, or, we might say, on the edge of evil. In light of this reasoning, the inescapability of pain takes on positive nuances, while theistic evolution is prompt to voice out the distaste for a deterministic world, which would be impressive, but rather boring, less interesting than the world in which we, in fact, find ourselves. It would have too much system and too little adventure, too much law and no history. Upholding the dynamism of the creative process, Eugene Peterson writes, "The moment the tidiness and strict orderliness becomes the rule of the day, creativity is inhibited, and the appearance of genuinely new slows way down. Thus, in order for novelty and creativity to occupy some space within the creation process, mess needs to be the precondition of creativity. I can never be involved in creativity except by entering the mess," he writes. Thus, painted in the hues of evolutionary history, pain becomes a necessary rather than a negative aspect of the growth of sentient life. Theistic evolution, therefore, abandons the negativity of suffering in favor of its necessity and even adopts positive views in regards to it. Seen in the light of this evolving character of the universe, what we call life's evil ceases theoretically to be outrageous from the moment when evolution becoming a genesis, the immense travail of the world displays itself as the inevitable reverse side, or better, the condition, or better still, the price of an immense triumph. It is clear that in this worldview, evolution does not turn out to be bad because of the inherent pain. Instead, suffering becomes good because it is inherent in evolution. Teilhard de Chardin is a champion in highlighting the positive aspects of pain. Suffering is good, he says, for it is a consequence and price of a labor of development. In view of the inevitability of pain mentioned above, Chardin goes on to interpret the cross event in evolutionary terms, thus magnifying the positive value of evolutionary pain. Physical and moral evil originate from a process of becoming. Everything which evolves experiences suffering and moral failure. The cross is a symbol of the pain and toil of evolution, rather than the symbol of expiation. Ralston joins in on the same tone and underscores the beauty in a cruciform world characterized by self-sacrificial love. In his view, the community of life on Earth is wonderfully creative and fruitful. It is continually being regenerated as well as continually being advanced. But creatures from the very beginning have given up their lives for others. The element of struggle, he says, in cruciform creation is deiform, godly, just because of this element of struggle, not in spite of it. Some theologians, therefore, not only accept pain as an inevitable aspect of a created order that looks like a package deal, they go further into perceiving divine love in the evolutionary process. Hod sees godly love in the freedom evolutionaries claim to offer. If God loves the world, then we can assume that God concedes to the world a certain degree of freedom to experiment with an array of possibilities in becoming. A God who withdraws and makes room for creation to become gratifies the theologian of evolution. As Hod put it, God so valued the world's independence and capacity for self-regulation that God took a non-interventionist stance. In other words, God wanted to respect the cosmic boundaries of life and allow the universe to differentiate itself from the Creator. This is a non-imposing God, a God who purposely restrains divine power out of love. Hod further paints positive nuances on God's character by pointing to evolution as a testimony for a self-humbling, self-emptying of divine power, which expresses love by letting the universe be. In the evolutionary model of creation, creaturely participation, according to their gifts, is a prerequisite for fully thriving. Howard Van Til proposes the concept of fully gifted creation to best encapsulate the idea of creaturely capabilities. He questions the traditional understanding of an exclusive creation in favor of the participatory one he embraces. Is God's creative act best described in a vocabulary that places special emphasis on episodes of miraculous intervention, or is it better described in a vocabulary that emphasizes God's giving of being to a creation that is richly gifted with the capabilities to organize and transform itself into new forms in the course of time? Theistic evolution attributes the God of a special creation display of power to coerce material into assuming forms, and argues that such a special creation would have been insufficiently equipped to actualize with its God-given capabilities. If creation's formation economy is not sufficiently robust, insufficiently robust meaning equipped with all the necessary capabilities to make it possible for creation to organize and transform itself from elementary forms of matter into the full array of physical structures and life forms that have existed in the course of time. If creation's formation economy is not sufficiently robust, then it must be the case that God intentionally chose to withhold it. By contrast, evolutionary creation claims the advantage to present just the opposite view of a coercive and exclusive God, a divine creator who chose not to withhold the creaturely self-organizing and self-transforming capabilities. In a similar vein, Simone Weil argues for divine love with the following analogy. We should think of a friend who has been away for a long time and who, upon returning, grips us very hard. It hurts, but the grip is in love. It feels just as painful as when it is a grip of someone who wants to hurt us. But in this case, it is the effect of one who loves and wants contact with us. Sometimes, she says, through the universe of matter, God grips us very hard. Theologians have wondered about the paradox between a fine-tuned universe and a messy world. One answer to this systemic contradiction resorts precisely to the love intrinsic in the evolutionary creation. Unlike cosmology, which requires regularity, biology needs irregularity in order to be meaningful, declares theistic evolution. Only a world of opposites, of values and disvalues, of good and evil can ensure love and success. The heavens are fine-tuned, and we are happy about the beauty and regularity there. But the heavens are also a world in which there is no caring. Earth, with itself, is a world in which things can get hurt. You cannot be helped in a world where you cannot be hurt. You cannot live biologically in a world in which you cannot die. And you cannot succeed in a world in which you cannot fail, argues theistic evolution. It appears that evolutionary creationists ascribe a different set of values to the biological world than to the cosmological world. In cosmology, regularity is an irreplaceable value from the point of view of life opportunity. In the biological world, however, history and autonomy must replace regularity in order to bring about a valuable world. It is more valuable, argues theistic evolution, to have history plus value, a story of achievement, rather than give elegant, optimal solutions without history or autonomy. The highest values are in story, not in law, in history, not in repeatability. The achievements of evolution do not have to be optimal to be valuable. In this first section, I looked into how different evolutionary creationists justify the goodness of God, considering evolutionary biological pain. Building upon the premise that death is a thermodynamic necessity, theistic evolution acknowledges that evolutionary suffering and death are inevitable in an evolutionary creation. Since pain and death are inevitable, the logical inference is that oppositional nature has always been the reality of the biological world. Rationalizing this view, theistic evolution argues that these values are necessary for values to exist, and lists history and autonomy as the highest values. Painted on the background of creaturely history and autonomy, the portrait of divine love presents us with a God who withdraws and allows the world the freedom and autonomy to become. The God of theistic evolution is a non-imposing, self-humbling, non-intervening creator who empties himself of divine power and lets the world be. Pain is God's grip of love towards a world he fully gifted with the self-regulatory capacities to appear and become, a world in the process of differentiating itself from the creator. Furthermore, creatures share in the divine self-sacrificial love through their death, which enables others to live. I will now turn to analyzing and critiquing the justification of God's goodness theistic evolutionary offers. As Stephen Bauer points out, the method of creation deepens our understanding of who God is and how he operates. Theistic evolution seeks to make a case for divine goodness and love. However, the arguments beat critique. Does the theistic evolutionary justification of God's benevolence stand on solid ground? Can an evolutionary creation truly portray a God of love? Can we justify the benevolence of God who creates through pain and death-filled processes? When confronted with the picture of God theistic evolution paints, it seems that often the highlight is on the humility of a God who takes a non-interventionist stance in order to allow the world to autonomously become. But some aspects of this non-interventionist stance beat inquiry. For example, what does it mean for creatures that God withdraws? Is the withdrawal implied in theistic evolution necessarily a positive aspect, as theistic evolution advocates? Does the withholding of divine power essentially and automatically suggest a good divine character? This divine withholding of power comes with a cost, the withholding of resources. The theory of evolution is construed upon the premise that animals have struggled due to the scarcity of resources. But limited resources point to either a limited God or an evil God. If he withheld the necessary resources for his creatures to subsist, then he is evil. Or else, if he was not able to provide, he is limited. For how can a good and infinitely powerful God can create an environment that only provokes strife resulting in bloodshed of creatures that have no choice but to fight, no alternatives but to kill so they live. Thus, the deficiency evolution indicates, as it speaks of a process of becoming, is very disquieting. It points to deficiency both in God as well as creatures. Because of scarce resources, not only is the picture of the animate world marred, red in tooth and claw, but God's very portrait is sprinkled with blood. On a similar note, the term fully gifted creation is meant to suggest creaturely capabilities. However, a serious concern arises from accepting this concept. A fully gifted creation implies a non-fully gifted God. Creatures endowed with a self-regulatory capabilities to come into life, but who have to fight for survival due to scarce resources, point to a God who is not fully gifted. If he is unable to provide the resources necessary for creatures to subsist without the need for strife, then he is not powerful, and if he has the ability to provide the resources but withholds them, then he is not good. Therefore, it does not seem possible to accept theistic evolution and at the same time also uphold all three of the classic properties of God's nature and biblical, I would argue, God's infinite love, intelligence, and power. Unfortunately, only some combination of two of these properties can coincide with theistic evolution. And this leads me to conclude that the God of theistic evolution is not a fully gifted God. A God who creates through evolution is dubitably a good God. In an evolutionary creation, we find whole genera and whole nations of animals perishing in succession, and this numerous times repeated as if their author were in sport, forming and destroying worlds again and again. One could hardly call this a good God. As Norman Gulley remarkably puts it, creation through horror is compatible with Satan's hatred of the cross, and not compatible with a loving creator redeemer who dies for others rather than inflicting death. Life through death is a biblical concept of atonement and not a biblical concept of creation. As noted above, in order for theistic evolution to be internally consistent, it must make room for suffering. It must make something of it. Since pain is part of the process, it must be woven into the creative act. This could be a laudable attempt to preserve the image of God, had it not abased both God and the creature in the endeavor. Theistic evolution seeks to justify the goodness of God by upholding the freedom in the process in which, if the environment can be good, that brings also the possibility of deprivation and harm. An environment in which things can go wrong just because they can also go right. However, this seems to be an incorrect appraisal of what theistic evolution entails. In an evolutionary creation model, things do go wrong so they can go right. Things must go wrong so they can go right. So by contrast with special creation, where life and good are actual, while death and evil are possible, theistic evolution contends that death and evil must be actual so life and good can be possible. Thus, in evolution, the possibility of life implies the necessity of death. The moment creatures become co-creators, blood appears and pain becomes an actuality. But pain, suggests Ralston, is a privilege of creatures who are called to share in the self-sacrificial love of God demonstrated at the Calvary. However, the victims of evolution do not even remotely resemble the divine self-sacrificial love of the cross. They do not yield their love for their lives for others voluntarily. They must fight or die, and even as they fight, they will ultimately be overcome. We cringe today at the early centuries games where blood and death delighted multitudes at the Colosseum. Yet we ascribe God the rules of this bloody game over the entire world and contend that he is a loving God. There is nothing about self-sacrificial love in theistic evolution. It seems that the concept of cruciform creation misapplies the notion of self-sacrifice and freedom. John Macquarie notes that the process of evolution on Earth's surface looks much more like a groping procedure of trial and error with fantastic waste than like the carrying through of a preconceived plan. What Macquarie describes as a groping process of trial and error, Eugene Peterson depicts through seemingly positive explanations when he speaks of the creative mess as prerequisite for novelty. However, it is one thing to discard unused paint dispensable part in music or tweak a line in a poem, and quite another to enforce this analogy on God's creative act in Genesis 1-2. The results are vastly dissimilar in art, as we experience it, and to which Peterson alludes, the discarded elements are not animate. In evolution, the parts discarded are capable of suffering. I wonder if someone would use a trial and error method involving immense pain of their loved ones and somehow think we could come short of a positive answer. Could it be then that we're applying a double standard where, oddly enough, God takes the least ethically appealing posture? If, as I assume, we would not indeed use a trial and error process involving immense pain of our loved ones, then in this restricted sense of applying trial and error that inflicts pain upon living organisms, we have advanced further than God himself, who is supposed to have employed this method in creation. The loss of a species is to be mourned, and theologians of evolution themselves struggle with this parting. Extinction, they say, is always a loss of value to the biosphere as a whole. A whole strategy of being alive on the planet, a whole quality of living experience is lost when an organism becomes extinct. Simone Weil sought to account for the animal pain through the imagery of divine grip of love. The extinction of a species, though, can be more accurately illustrated through the image of a tight squeeze that annihilates forever. Evolution points not only to painful grips, but to deathly grips as well, both of which I find problematic. God's love thus becomes a love that kills without any other reason than creatures being ill-prepared to survive. One could hardly discern the full giftedness of creation. On the contrary, it seems that evolution implies many creatures, entire species, are not gifted enough to survive and therefore are sacrificed. Loss and death on an unthinkable scale are built into the way things are in an evolutionary world, and we are to believe such a scheme testifies of a good God. The concern is not only about creatures as species, but also about the fate of individual animals. Southgate draws attention to this when he notes that the experience of many individual living creatures seems to be all suffering and no richness. These unfulfilled organisms may be regarded in some sense as victims or casualties of evolution. Casualties have always been the weak, the vulnerable, and perhaps the most disheartening, the innocent. As we have seen, rather than being a clear manifestation of intelligent design and protective guidance, the world is riddled with violence, a very brutal drama in which the weak, the disadvantaged, and the ill-prepared are simply destroyed. Being weak, disadvantaged, and ill-prepared is not a choice on the part of animals. It is a given. Van Til's concept of full giftedness falls short of suggesting a best creative method, because a full giftedness pointing to a God who would to a good God would imply not only the self-regulatory capacities for emerging life, but also the capacity to preserve life, the ability to live a fulfilled life, protected and shared with others. Some evolutionary creationists reaffirm Origen's view on suffering as necessary for personal growth towards maturity in a worldview's of as a realm of soul-making. If this were true about humans, however, it certainly cannot justify the pain of animals who are not souls in the making. As C.S. Lewis starkly put it, the problem of animal suffering is appalling, not because the animals are so numerous, but because the Christian explanation of human pain cannot be extended to animal pain. So far as we know, beasts are incapable either of sin or virtue. Therefore, they can neither deserve pain or be improved by it. Thus, there is a real problem in affirming with Genesis 1:31 that this creation is very good, and indeed that it is a creation of a good God. The evolutionary history presents us with the fact of the suffering of myriad creatures, and even worse, the thought that this suffering serves a purpose in refining species and spurring them on to new and ever more complex and ingenious evolutionary strategies, including those of rationality and consciousness. The victims of evolution, therefore, seem to be merely means to a divine end. In a process where living creatures experience unavoidable pain as means to an end, which does not even benefit them, I can only discern a God who abuses of the innocent and the vulnerable, or allows the abuse of the innocent and the vulnerable. Finally, the God of theistic evolution is a God we could dispense of. Darwin himself made it clear that this theory has anti-religious implications. The function of natural selection is, after all, to sift our harmful variations and preserve only the beneficial ones. But if we admit God in the process, Darwin argued, then God would ensure that only the right variations occurred, and so natural selection would be superfluous. In this section, I sought to analyze and critique the justification of divine benevolence theistic evolution offers in view of the animal suffering and death inherent in an evolutionary creation. Instead of a loving God and a good God, evolutionary creationists seek to portray it. I have discovered that an evolutionary creation points to a limited, evil God who determines the existence and persistence of evil, winks at the general loss and disregards the individual loss, a God of uncertainty and mess, who creates weak and vulnerable living organisms who are insufficiently well equipped to subsist and who come alive without a guarantee of protection. All the contrary, who are due to experience abuse, a God who ultimately we could dispense of since natural selection operates on autonomous laws. At the end of my research, I'm left with two main concerns. Number one, an unsatisfactory justification of God's goodness on the part of theistic evolution, and flowing from this, number two, the inflexibility of theistic evolution and when it comes to construing arguments and justification, despite the clear and serious implications the premise they build upon leads to. If, when confronted with the extent of the issue, theistic evolution reflects back on the only way argument, which, for lack of better support, turns into a best way argument, then I'm afraid we're twisting logic to fit goodness in a way that this simply doesn't fit. The only way cannot become the best way just because it is presumed to be the only way. If indeed evolution was the only way, then it's not necessarily implicit in this that it is a good way either. Yet the only way remains the ultimate resort, as even theologians deeply concerned with animal suffering, such as Christopher Southgate, demonstrate. I'm quoting here, "Lurking behind the formulations of redeemed life at the eschaton is the question, why, if an alternate physics makes possible an alternate and pain-free cosmos, did not God create this in the first place? Since this, he says, was a world that the God of all creativity and compassion chose to create, we must presume that this was the only type of world that would do for the process. In other words, our guess must be that though heaven can eternally preserve those selves, subsisting in suffering-free relationships, it could not give rise to it in the first place. This is the only way argument, basically. Theistic evolution seeks to make peace between science and theology. The cost, I'm afraid, is higher than recognized. We are asked to sacrifice the character of God in order to appease human discovery. We are to trade a powerful and loving God for a weak and bloody God. It is striking to me that the portrait of God's character in theistic evolution resembles so much what we humans have experienced of ourselves and of each other. We humans are limited and evil. We are those who actualized evil and brought about not only its presence but also its persistence. History has proven that as a race, we're capable of generating massive pain and loss of living creatures. Think of genocides, and we're acquainted well with what it means to disenfranchise the individual pain and loss. We're beings living in uncertainty, we're creatures of mess, weak and vulnerable, abused and abusive, and we can all too easily dispense of each other. Perhaps the most important aspect of all this is recognizing that we need a God whom we can trust, worship, and follow. Evolution and the soul-making concept both imply that we learn from our own experiences, rather than from our Creator. These values, giving rise to values, help us grow in the consciousness of morality, truth, and goodness. The Bible, on the other hand, invites us to follow a God who is, will always be, and has always been worthy of trust, worship, and following. Following Him would ensure that we can be transformed more and more according to His image, lest we continue to alter and lower God more and more into our image. Thank you.